He got a doctorate of history from London. He was sent to Europe by his brother. His brother was the head of the family because his father was dead when he was 5 years old. He got a large family, 8 children, 2 sisters married. They're both living still, older than he. And there were 6 brothers in all, 2 6-brothers and 2 sisters. And they belonged to a very old Brahmin family. His brother, Asoka, I don't know if he's living still, if he's living he must be over 80, is perfectly, well, he would take him for a European if you see him. And Mr. Mukherjee himself, if you see Sophia Vare, who is Greek, this is a European, he was fairer than her in complexion. I wouldn't say he was like you, no, he had dark eyes. He had dark eyes, and he had, he was a Mediterranean type, but he was fairer than Sophia, who was a European. And one brother is a little darker than he, his sister is darker than he was, one of the fairest.
Mm.
And he felt Aryan. You know, the Brahmins of Bengal are not really Bengalis. Bengal, in the early Middle Ages, up to the 12th century, beginning of the 12th century, was a Buddhist country. Buddhists have no caste. That is to say, there was a mixture. There was a mixture of Aborigines, Dravidians, all sorts of people, but no Brahmins. Came a dynasty after the Pals called the Sen dynasty, and the second king of that dynasty, called Balala Sen, wanted to introduce the caste system into Bengal. So he had to import Brahmins. There were none. He imported them from North India. He imported several families, and those families married only among themselves, because there are very strict rules of marriage in India. You have to marry within your Sreni. Sreni is a subdivision of a caste. And outside your Gotra. Gotra is a subdivision of a Sreni. For instance, a Mukherjee is what they call in Bengal a Rari Brahmin. He should marry the daughter of a Rari Brahmin, but not a Mukherjee. Something outside his Gotra. His Gotra is, all the Mukherjees are one Gotra. He has to marry a Banerjee or a Chatterjee or a Ganguly. But not one of a different Sreni. Not a Lahiri, not a Maitra, not people, not what they call the Barendra Brahmins. He has to marry within the Rari Brahmins. Now you tell me, how did he marry you? Well, he married me for me not to be interned at the beginning of the war. If he had not married me, I would have been in a concentration camp. All people that were against the British, that were known to be against the British, known to have subversive ideas, they were immediately after the war put into camps. So we married at the outbreak of the war in September 1939. And we had no kind of marital life at all. We just stayed as we were. We were ideological co-fighters, friends, and that's all. Even if we lived under the same roof. We had, in fact, 4 rooms in Calcutta, 2 for me and 2 for him. And we used to meet now and then. That was our life. We didn't want any family. So if we don't, our principles, his principles and mine, if you don't want a family, you have no business of having anything else but platonic relations with your fellow beings. Ceasing platonic relations is only when you want a family. That's my idea. It's a waste of time and waste of energy. It's not a plaything. God didn't give these functions to people as a pastime or as a plaything or as an entertainment. It's given for a purpose that is the sacred purpose of continuing the race.
That's right.
That's all. And now, according to Aryan tradition in India, if the Brahmin, a Marari Brahmin, is not allowed to marry even a Barendra Brahmin of Bengal, how can he be allowed to marry something else outside? He's not allowed to marry a Kashmiri Brahmin. He's not allowed to marry a Madrasi Brahmin, even if the Kashmiri Brahmin is perfectly white. So, regularly, according to tradition, we shouldn't have married at all. All right, we married and we did a religious marriage, according to Hindu rites, because I had embraced Hinduism long before I met him. I had embraced Hinduism because it was the only religion in the world that is compatible with National Socialism. I told him, first of all, I'm a disciple of Adolf Hitler. And if I must have some religious denomination, well, I call myself rather a Hindu than a Christian. I don't believe. And that is one of the things I have against the propaganda in America. This mixing up of Christianity and National Socialism. They are incompatible, philosophically speaking. One is a Jewish product mixed with some sprinkling of Greek ideas. It's originally Jewish, you can't get out of it. You go to a cathedral, you see the Jewish prophets there, along with the saints. Who are the saints? Well, if they are the apostles, most of them are Jews. Whatever you like. You can't get out of it. Now, there are ideas that are non-Jewish in Christianity. For instance, the idea of a man dying and resurrecting for the sins of the world. That is not Greek either. It's further back. It's Iranian. It comes from Mitra. Now, you get the same kind of thing with Osiris, with Adonis, with all these vegetation gods. It symbolizes the corn, the grain of corn. If the grain of corn doesn't die, it cannot resurrect. It dies in the winter and resurrects in spring. So all these gods of vegetation, well, somebody picked on Christ, picked on Jesus. Now you have, do you know the French books of Robert Gamelin? Never heard of it. If you possibly can get three books of Robert Gamelin, you read French.
No, I understand that just a little bit, but I...
Well, anyhow, take these books. I'll give you the address of the editor. They were lent to me by this French lady. They are extraordinary. And they are all the more convincing that the man is not a Jew, he's an Aryan, but he's pro-Jew. He's a very good Hebrew scholar. He knows Hebrew as I know French or English or Greek. And he is... Well, I mean to say, he's a historian and a high-graded Freemason on top of that. And he, in trying to prove something, what he really gets up his nose is the antagonism between Christianity, especially medieval Christianity, and the Jews. He says that, may his blood fall on us and on our children. He says that is an interpolation. The new Jews never said that. Why were they persecuted for saying that when they never said it? Well, personally, I don't care if they said it or not. To me, it's quite immaterial. To him, the person of Jesus is the son of a Jewish anti-Roman agitator. And he was himself an anti-Roman agitator and nothing else. No teacher of any sort of religion. Just an anti-Roman that was condemned to death by the Romans by the cross. Well, if he were really, that's perfectly true, if he were really condemned by the Jews on the charge of blasphemy for calling himself God, first he never called himself God. He always said, the Father and I. There are things I do not know, but the Father knows. But even if he had called himself God and were condemned by the Jews, according to Jewish law, for blasphemy, he would not have been crucified. He would have been stoned. The Jewish custom was stoning, lapidation, and not crucifying. He's a Roman. He was condemned by the Romans, not for calling himself God, but for saying King of the Jews, and for activities, resistance activities. He was a Jewish maquisard, what they call in French maquisard, according to Amblin. His father also, and his grandfather also. His grandfather, Ezekias, was supposed to be crucified on the Herod. And then, later on, Paul. Now, according to this Amblin also, Paul was no insignificant little Jew. He was one-third, one-fourth Jewish, and three-fourths Idumean, that is to say Arab, of the dynasty of the Herods. He was the grandson of Herod the Great by his mother Cyprus. And he was neither in the Arab gang, nor in the Jewish. He was circumcised. He had himself circumcised when he was aged. As you see, he was not circumcised as a baby. He had no place among the Jews. The Jews don't like neophytes that come when they are older, and that come for perhaps non-religious reasons. So he tried to find a sect of his own. He took, according to Amblin, always, I'm speaking of Amblin's theory, I don't know if it's true or not. According to Amblin, he took the person of that Jewish agitator and made it into a mystic figure, added to him all the characteristics of these age-old vegetation gods, Mitra, Osiris, and others, and said the disciples of Jesus already used to spread the rumor that he was resurrected. So half the job was done. He only had to say yes, he was resurrected, and he rose from the dead for the salvation of the world. He made him into a world figure, when in reality he was only a Jewish figure. And by this doing that, he spread an influence of Jewry on the whole world. You have a perfect Aryan girl, a German, called Ruth, or called Sarah. You have an Englishman called David. You have an Englishman, Isaac Newton, called Isaac. What is all that? What is that stuff? You have a man called Johannes. Johannes is Yochanan, is the Hebrew. Yochanan is John. The whole thing has changed. After the spreading of Christianity, after the acceptance of Christianity as a state religion by the Roman emperors after Constantine, it seems that then the Gospels, as we know them today, were written. They haven't got the same ones. There is no manuscript of any Gospel except one or two, what they call the Apocrypha. And even then, there's no manuscript contemporary of Christ in the world. The first ones are of the 4th century AD. Those we have, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, well, in reality, they were other names. These people wrote these, we said they were written in the 4th century AD. And the Gospels that the churches used to have in their hands, the Christians used to use before that date, they were taken back to Constantinople by order of Constantine. And by 50, packets of 50. And packets of 50 were given, new ones were given to them, the new ones we have today. And there are queer things in them. For instance, in the Gospel according to Matthew, Christ is born under Herod. Herod died in 4 BC. Therefore, he was born before 4 BC. Maybe 5, 6, 7 BC. According to Luke, he was born under the magistrateship of the Roman Quirinus. Quirinus ruled Palestine before Pilate. That is to say, in about 6 AD. That is to say, if he was born 4 BC, he would be at least 10 years old. Which is the right birth? Why does one say this and one that one says that? Anyhow, this umbrella picked the Gospel right through the canonical ones and the apocryphal ones that have been surviving in Coptic translation, in Slavon translation, in all sorts of Ethiopian translations. He has gone through all that. And he has given a figure of Jesus that is not at all the classical one. Well, long before I knew this, I learned this when I read the books of Amblin. That's not such a long time ago. But long before this, I was feeling all the time. And that's one of the reasons why I got out of it. That's one of the reasons why I went to Palestine in 29. Before 29, I used to love the Orthodox Christian Church. I didn't like the Christian values. But I liked the Byzantine music. And I was told from when I was a child, this is the national church of Greece. Greece, modern Greece, comes from Byzantium. I mean, say is the daughter of Byzantium as much as the daughter of ancient Greece. So the chanting, the hymns, the music, all that I liked. And I understood that the values were absolutely against my own values. So I said, I'm going to fight them. But before fighting them, I must see the cradle of Christianity. And I went to Palestine in April of 29 with a Greek pilgrimage to stay there 40 days. And I was not conscious of being a National Socialist then. I had very good memories of Adolf Hitler, yes. I had not seen him, but I had followed his movement from 1923. The first time I heard of him was in 1923 after the putsch, the 9th of November. I was in Athens then, and I heard of it. And my reaction was, why didn't he succeed? That would have given these swine a lesson. Who were these swine? The Allies. My opinion. I didn't like them. I was against the Allies in the First World War. And why was I against them? Because in 1914, the Allies used to tell us, I mean, say through the papers, but I used to hear, I was in 1914, I was eight and a half years old, nearly nine. It didn't happen when the war broke out. But I knew, they were telling us that the schools of Germans were barbarous monsters because they went through Belgium without asking the permission. It was 1914. I said, all right. I accepted it. But in 1915, when the French landed in Salonika, Greece, without asking the permission of the Greek people, I said, why are they not monsters? If it is a monster's qualification to land in a country without asking permission, then the French must be also like the Germans, they were put in the same bag. Why are they not? And then came the pressure upon Greece to enter the war. They forced Greece into the war. Greece didn't want to go into the war. They blockaded the Greek ports for 10 months. The English fleet did that. And then the French and English bombarded Athens in 1917. In 16 already, it was in 16, in December 16. That's, they call that the Danoem Vienna, the November days, in Greek, because the calendar is 13 days different.
Oh, yeah.
Anyhow, I remember that, and when I saw that, I didn't know what I was to do. I was only a kid. In 16, I was 11. And before that, I was in 15, I was 10. I'm born in 5, 30th of September 5. I stole some chalk from the school one night, one evening. Told my mother I was going to see a friend in the neighborhood. She said, yes, you can go. Instead of going to my friend's house, I went behind the newly built railway station. It was a place perfectly dark. And I took my chalk and I wrote, A bas les Alliés, vive l'Allemagne. Down with the Allies, long live Germany. During the war, 1960. That was a protest against the legend that the Allies were right, whatever they did, and the Germans were wrong, whatever they did. I hated that hypocrisy. It's hypocrisy that really went off ground or got off my nose.
And you were 11 years of age at that time?
At that time, in end of 16, I was 11. In 15, I was 10. Anyhow, I have this remembrances of the war. I have remembrances of the Balkanic War. When I was 6 and 7, I can remember very far back. I can remember my perambulator. It was sold when I was 2. My mother told me she sold it when I was 2. I remember it very well. Very well. Things that have nothing to do with National Socialism. I remember being sick of peaches, sick in my perambulator. I remember the bedcloth, white and blue tassels. I used to pull the tassels and say, you come, you come. You come and throw them away. And I remember once we went in the park of my native town and I had to put my hand outside my perambulator and it was all wet. I said, Mammy, what's that? I only spoke English because my mother was English. She was Cornish. So I put my hand out and I said, what's that? She said, that's the dew. Oh, that was a new word. Until we came home, I repeated, dew, 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 dew. I remember that as though it was yesterday. I was 1 and a half about. I have a good memory for things. And things that impress me, I remember them always. Always. Well, for instance, I remember, I'll tell you that later on. I remember snails. Our neighbor, we had, if you put live snails in vinegar, pour les faire dégorger, to make them froth out, to eat them. I said, the poor snails. I always loved animals. And was always indignant at any kind of action of humans against animals. I refused to take meat. My mother and father didn't take meat very often. They took meat on festival days. Sometimes Sundays and say Christmas, Easter, things like days like that. But I didn't want to eat even those days. But for Christmas, I had peas in butter, boiled peas in butter. That was my Christmas dinner. And a slice of plum pudding made with butter. She didn't make it with suet. Because she knew it, and I wouldn't have eaten it otherwise. I had very strong ideas. And nothing could have made me change. They told me, they used to give, you know, missionary literature to me. The little girl, brought up in a cannibal surrounding, mission school comes to the village, and she's indignant at the idea of eating people, and the people of the enemy tribes. And she ends up becoming a Christian. I used to tell people openly, if you call that superior, and if you must admire this little girl, why don't you admire me? I have standards. I didn't say it in those words, of course. whatever. I meant my standards of behavior are higher than yours. You don't respect animals, I do. So why don't you admire me if I have to admire this little girl? That was insolent. I was as insolent as possible. Never was afraid of being insolent. Unless I was severely punished, like in school. In school, I knew that I had to keep my mouth shut according to good Christianity in the Catholic school. And in the council school, where I went afterwards, I had to keep my mouth shut about the French Revolution, which I hated. But once the Declaration of the Rights of Man, I don't know how you call it in English, Declaration des Droits de l'Homme, there was a panel in the corridor. And one day, I was about 11, I asked for permission to go to the WC, excuse me. And they said, all right, you go. I didn't go, I went to the corridor, and stood in front of the panel. They did this awful gesture, it's very rude to do that in French. I did that at it. And the headmistress caught me. She said, why are you doing that? I said, because that's all lies. Who told you that your father? I said, no, my father is for it. He likes that stuff, but I don't. Why don't you like it? Why do you think it's lies? I said, because equality is a lie. And he said, how do you think equality is? I said, because a beautiful girl is not equal to an ugly girl. An ugly girl is inferior. And I named two girls of my class. I said, so-and-so, I like so-and-so. She's a good girl, but she's inferior to this one. This one's a beauty. Blonde, very blonde, blue-eyed girl, beautiful girl. Called Aimé Villon. Remember her name. And the headmistress could say nothing. She said, well, you'll be punished. So I said, punish me if you like. I don't mind. And not for the French Revolution. You'd rather be a serf under the kings. I said, a serf under the kings, I'd have something to love. The majesty of the king is something that can dazzle me. But there's no majesty in a republic. In an aggregate of so many hundreds of men that give out decisions, what is there to love in them? What is there to love in them? They're not a person. I can love a person. I can't love an assembly. I stayed there, they didn't say anything else to me. I left them there. But I was quite young. And then one thing that upset me from my childhood when I was five is experiments on animals. Circuses, the fur industry, all things were animals, are they victims? Experiments on animals, never. I said, as long as that exists, I'm not going to say a word against things that happen to human beings. And to this day, when I hear the things that go on in Africa, in Uganda, I mean, Dada is supposed to be a monster, a tyrant, whatever you like. I couldn't care less. As long as they put up with experiments on animals in their laboratories, I'm not going to criticize Amin Dada. He's a Negro, well, let him do what he likes. After all, his victims are also Negroes. Well, I couldn't care less. Negroes among Negroes. Let them do it. The last thing I would have done, I used to cry and keep silence on the 12th of October, because on that day Columbus landed in America. And I was against it. I didn't want Americans to be spoiled. I knew they had beautiful monuments. They had human sacrifices, of course. I couldn't care less, it was among themselves. And the victims used to like it. The victims found it an honor. It was an honor to have your chest cut open and your heart pulled out and offered to the gods. All right, if you like, if the fuck can consider it an honor, carry on. I don't care. I never would have stopped that. If I'd been the Spaniards, and if the Spaniards had been National Socialists, supposing Europe had been keeping its old national religions and never became a Christian Europe. And of course the Spanish, some Europeans would have gone to America and conquered America, all right. They would have taken a lot of the gold. They would have exploited people quite right. They are the strongest exploit the weakest. But they would have left the gods and the monuments as they were. And that's all I liked. I would like to be able to see Tenochtitlan, as this is Mexico City, as it was in 1519, when the Spanish landed there. It must have been beautiful. These pyramids, with the temple on the top, and these stairs. Of course, when the victim was killed, and they sent his body downstairs, and people used to cut it up and eat it, well, I couldn't care less. It's not worse than eating beef for me. Not worse. If you offer me to eat one or the other, I'd say neither, please. Neither.
Exactly.
And after all, if I have to eat some flesh, I'd rather eat the flesh of an enemy than of a creature that never did a thing against me. And it doesn't hate what I love and doesn't love what I hate. Say a lamb. And what is it, is there anything more beautiful than a little lamb? The Aztecs used to eat, well, they didn't used to eat them completely, they used to take a little bit off, just as a, what they call in Hindi a prasad, and say, part of the offering. Of the offering. The offering was a warrior. It was always a warrior that they had defeated. Now the warriors liked it. I don't know if you know the story, or you heard of the story of Tlahuicol. Tlahuicol was a Tlaxcaltec warrior of the 15th century. This was not under Montezuma II, who had to deal with the Spaniards, but under his grandfather, Montezuma I, who was a great warrior. That is to say, between 1427 or 28 and 1469. He died in 1469, this one. This Tlaxcaltec warrior, Tlaxcala and Tenochtitlan, were always at war, two cities of Mexico. Tlaxcala was defeated, warriors were taken, and they had to be sacrificed, not in the ordinary war god festival, but in the fire festival. That was much worse. In the fire festival, the victim was made to fight alone with a wooden sword against five Aztec warriors with stone swords. They didn't know metal. Metal was not known. They couldn't make steel. They had iron, but they didn't know it. They knew gold and silver and stone. They were living in the Stone Age, if you like. But with beautiful works of art, they used to have clothes made of feathers and whatnot. They had an art. And you only have to see the Aztec art. So he was there. And generally he was defeated, naturally. Five with stone swords against one with a wooden sword. But this one was not defeated. Once defeated, he was supposed to be thrown into a fire. And half burnt, he was pulled out with some cooks or tongs or something. And then his heart, his breast opened, and his heart pulled out and offered to the fire god. That was the procedure. Now, Tlahuicol knew it very well. He was dead. To the amazement of everybody, including Montezuma I, he defeated with his wooden sword. He defeated the five Aztecs with a stone sword, one after the other. Montezuma II said, stop. This man is more than a man. Nobody ever done such a performance. Now, Tlahuicol, I don't want you to be sacrificed. You are too precious. Take command of my own army, and you won't be sacrificed. And Tlahuicol answered, what? To march against Tlaxcala tomorrow, my own city? Never. Let the feast continue. Let the ceremony continue. He refused. Well, I find that so wonderful, so beautiful. And he was a non-Aryan, mind you. He was a non-Aryan, he was a red Indian. I found him worthy of being told his story to another Aryan of mine, an English friend I had then. On the top of the Externstein. She came to Germany and we went to the Externstein together. And I told her, we were talking with Mexican things. I said, wait till we come to the top of the Externstein. And there in the sunroom, I will tell you the story of a sun-worshipping warrior, Tlahuicol of Tlaxcala. He deserves it. Aryan or non-Aryan, he deserves it. Well, I used to be feeling that way. And when I think of the Inquisition in America, so many people burnt alive in horrors, like the same horrors as in Europe, in the name of the Catholic Church. I felt disgusted. I felt better than these sacrifices in which the victim himself thought it was an honor, at least. He had nothing against it. Like the satis in India, you know, the widows that were burnt alive of their own free will, according to religion. I don't see that pressure was not done upon some of them, but as a principle, as a law, they were only victims voluntarily. Well, I wouldn't have stopped that with the British. There were so many other things to stop. Not that. We stopped at last. The first thing they stopped. There was one in my husband's family, one sati, only a few years ago, I mean, say, perhaps, say 20, 30 years ago. She did it on purpose. could fall to our own power. Well, when he died, I cut off my hair, clipped it off. And that's why it's not long now. It's a year and a half ago, a little more than a year and a half ago. It grows slowly at my age. So I haven't got enough hair now, long enough to make a mop. I'm leaving it grow. But when he died, I cut it off, very short. And I went to the ceremony. He was burning. He was burned on a funeral pyre, like the old Vikings were, like we were all in Europe in the old days before Christianity. And I stood by the pyre. I said to myself, what if I had to sit in the middle of it, like the old sultans? It needs courage. It needs a tremendous courage to sit in the fire. Unless you have the capacity by yoga, take out your etherical body and put it away. And I think some people have that capacity. Because when the Buddhists were burning themselves alive, some of them, some Buddhist monks in Vietnam, I remember the death of Thich Quang Duc on the 12th of June, 1963. It is another thing I saw on the television, somebody else's television. You could have seen the serene expression of that monk. He lighted the fire himself with a lighter, poured himself with kerosene, and the wood with kerosene, lighted the fire. And he stood in the flames. You could see him in the television. He had the serene, indifferent expression of myself when I was supervising a class. Class boys were doing their home task. I was looking at them, see that nobody copies on somebody else. That kind of expression. And then he got black and blacker and blacker, carbonized and dropped. Without a scream, without a struggle. And I think that if he had not the capacity of taking away what they call the etheric body among the theosophists, it is the body that feels, because our physical body doesn't feel. It's the etheric one that does, the subtle body. The first subtle body, the grossest among the seven, among the six other subtle bodies. If he had not that capacity, he couldn't have done that. Put your finger in the fire and see what it feels like. Let alone the whole body. I imagine the burnings of the Middle Ages were horrid. There must have been screaming. You were tired, of course. But what I find even worse than that in the Middle Ages, at least in France and Germany and Belgium and some of the other places, was the burning of live cats. I don't know if you ever heard of that.
No.
You see, whatever was revered, whatever was good in pre-Christian Europe was considered bad by the Middle Ages after Christianity ruled. And cats were among the things. The number 13. Number 13 was good in Germanic, say, tradition. It is a bad number. Cats were well kept and loved in Europe, in pre-Christian Europe. In Christian Europe, they became the embodiment of the devil, especially black ones, because when you carry a black cat in the storm, it gives it sparks. So that was very bad. That was devilish. And they burnt cages full of cats on the St. John's Festival, you see the summer solstice. They were thinking they were feasting St. John. Must have been horrid. Poor cats in the cage, and then the cage burning. The bars became red hot. Poor cats were inside. Or else they had a pole. The cats would run up the pole and fall down back into the fire. That was the entertainment of people. In France it was done, and in France you have a place called Saint-Chamond, 20 kilometers from my native town. The inhabitants of Saint-Chamond are not called Saint-Chamonnais. They have a name that has nothing to do with Saint-Chamond. They are called chasse-minetier, meaning to say the pursuers of pussies. Minet is a pussy. Those who pursue run after pussies. Up till 1875, they had a custom. They had a power for St. John's. They tied a poor cat by its tail above the fire. And the string burnt, naturally. The string was the first thing to burn. It was the lightest thing. Poor cat would fall into the flames and then run away. and they would run after the burning cat in the streets. Chasse minutier. And I heard of all that when I was a child. It put me absolutely against mankind. And when I started hearing of some movement in Germany, National Socialist Movement, it's inhuman. Inhuman, I said, goodness me, I'm going to go in it. It's inhuman, I like it. It's inhuman, but all good, very good. I wouldn't have touched it if it was human. It's inhuman, all right. And then another thing drew me to it. It's this. I grew up partly among my mother's English friends, which I didn't like very much. I found them dull. The conversation was dull. They always spoke of it. People that were sick, so-and-so had an operation, so-and-so is boring. So yeah. It was boring. And then the church. What did the clergyman say in his speech? It was boring to her. But I had the Greek colony. And those Greeks were mostly Greeks of Asia Minor. And they had an idea. Well, all the Greeks had that idea. They called it the Megalia there, the great idea. The dream of all Greeks in one state. Those of Greece, of course, those of Thrace, those of the coast of Asia Minor on the Black Sea, those of the coast of Asia Minor on the Aegean Sea, capital Constantinople. The reconstruction of the Byzantine Empire to the profit of the modern Greeks. That was the dream of everyone. Even when they had a marriage festival or something, or some ceremony, the last toast, the last health they would carry, Christian body, and let us go to Constantinople, children. I grew up with that. And the first time I heard about Hitler, it was at the time of the putsch. I said, what did he want, really? He wanted to put all Germans in one state. Well, he has the same idea as I. All the Greeks in one state, all the Germans in one state. There's nothing wrong in that. Why are they all against them? Why don't they want all Germans in one state? It's against the Treaty of Versailles. Treaty of Versailles is an infamy. It separated people that should not be separated. It put together people that were not to be put together. Czechoslovakia is the Pakistan of Europe. They put together Czechs and Slovaks who hate each other, and some Ruthenians and some Ukrainians, and 3.5 million Germans who didn't want to be there. Wanted that to be Germany. I can understand them. But all I thought in those days was, I had admiration for this German patriot who fought exactly for his country as I would have liked to fight for Greece. I made the parallel, nothing more. And then I went to Palestine. I had the old Aryan Greek ideal. I said, well, why did we change our gods, really? But I'm going to see what Palestine looks like. What does the cradle of this foreign religion look like? And I went there. And I went in a Greek pilgrimage, of course, in April 29. April and May, we stayed till the end of May. Visited the place thoroughly. I saw these old ladies, and some young ones, flat on their bellies, kissing the earth, a holy people, holy place, holy land. Whatever they saw, some relic of the days of Christ, and they're all faked, mind you. You know the, what you call it, cross with Christ's figure on it. There are 39 of them in the whole world, not one. And I don't know how many foreskins, there's one foreskin of little Jesus at the Vatican. I think the whole lot of them, there are about 19 or 20 dispersed in all the world. But he didn't have 19 foreskins, he had one naturally, everybody has one, all males. So, things like that. The contortions, the signs of exaltation in front of the slightest thing. I said, goodness me, what influence of Jewry, what grip of Jewry on our race. And then I said to myself, who is going to free us from that? And suddenly it dawned on me, this was in April, I don't know if it was the 20th, I hope it was the 20th, but I didn't notice it then. It dawned on me, I said, this man, this German, who's fighting. But he's not really fighting for the Versailles Treaty, to suppress the Versailles. Of course he wants to suppress the Versailles Treaty, but what he really wants more than anything else is to free his Germans, his compatriots, and all other Aryan people. We are, after all, the same kind of people as the Germans, there's no difference. We have dark eyes, perhaps, and they have blue, but I wouldn't say that's the only difference. Otherwise, we are the same race. He wants to free us all from this Jewish grip. Well, good for him. Then he's not only the German Führer, he's also mine. And that's how we get conscious. In Palestine, for all places, and in 1929. And I came back to Greece. Of course, if I had not, I was born with French nationality. Because any child born in France, of whatever parentage, is automatically French nationality until he's 21. And at 21, he can do what he likes. Well, owing to the things that I heard concerning the First World War, I didn't want French nationality. When I was 21, I came to Greece and I asked for Greek nationality. I got it at once. Being of Greek descent on my father's side, I got it at once. Although the ministry, home ministry, told me, Miss Portasi, why are you doing that? You have all the advantages to stay French citizen. I said, I don't want to be the compatriot of Franck Lambillon and General Sarai, the one who landed at Salonika and the one who in March 1921 made the secret Franco-Turkish, well, not so secret, that was in the papers, the Franco-Turkish treaty, where the French helped the Turks during the Turkish-Greek campaign, Turkish-Greek War of 2022. I said, I'm not the compatriot of these two, so I rather have a good night. What will you live on? So I'll give lessons. But anybody does that without diplomas. You have diplomas. I said, I don't care. I want, you'll look at it when you're old. Well, I'm nearly 74 now, and I don't regret it, not even today. It's not true. People told me, they told me all sorts of things. You'll regret not knowing this, you'll regret not knowing that, not trying this, not trying that. I said, there's so many things I can't try. To be in love, you never were in love, you'll regret it one day. I don't regret it at all. I regret I couldn't see Peru. Yes, that I regret. I regret I never went to Germany during the great days. I couldn't go. Anyhow, why didn't I go in 1929? I didn't go because I said to myself, now it's a struggle. It's a struggle. How will a foreigner be accepted? I don't want to go as a tourist. I want to go as one and put myself in the struggle. But they would say, this woman, she was born in France, born French. She took Greek nationality 2 years ago. What is she doing now? What does she want with us now? Is she a spy or something like that? I was fearless, afraid of suspicion. So I said, no, I'm not going. I'm going to another place. And if I can't get on in Greece, I'll go to another place. I tried my best in Greece, but the opposition came from the church. I couldn't do nothing. People always said to me, the church, and that's national church, you can't go against it. All right, I said, I'll go somewhere else. Why I chose India? Because India is the one place in the world. The one place with multiracial population. And with that, in that multiracial population is, in theory at least, classified, hierarchized under the Aryan. It's not, in fact. I didn't know that. According to history, according to what it should be, according to Hinduism, it should be hierarchized under Aryan rule. Well, I said to myself, I'm going there. And then I heard that there was outlook, not man-centered in India, but life, it was life-centered. Man was not everything, animals were respected. I thought so. I knew, when I came here, I heard that there were experiments done upon them. I said that if that would be the British rule, when the British rule away, they'd stop that. They didn't stop it. On the contrary, it went on and on. The British infected the minds of the Indians with democratic ideas and humanitarian ideas. And now it's nothing to be done. But I stay here because I'm here. What will I do in France? I'm too old to get reclassed. Nobody will take me. I have no job. Nothing to live on. Here, at least I have a little pension, which would be nothing in France. But at least it keeps me alive here, pays my rent. And one or two lessons, I pull through. Well, you have to begin this.
Okay.
I gave you a sketch, you see. Uh-huh. A sketch. Another thing that's very important in my childhood was this. I was about eight. It was before the First World War. I was playing in the park, big park, public park in my native town, Lyon, and it started raining. Well, they said, it's raining now, we have no umbrellas, where must we go? The museum is nearby. What do you want to see? We go into the museum. We went into the museum. The hall, the first hall, was Assyrian sculptures. There was a mummy there, there were several things. He said, where do you want to go? Do you want to see the antiquities or do you want to see the animals? I said, I don't want to see the animals. The animals are stuffed. They are stuffed. I want to see antiquities. All right, she said, we'll go to the antiquities. So we went upstairs. It smelt of sandalwood and incense. And I inhaled it deeply. I liked it. And there were Tibetan pictures and there were Siamese pictures. I liked the style too. I was in the Orient at once. From the street into the Orient. I liked it. And then my mother said to me, well, we're going to see the room. I saw the Indian room, and I saw the Chinese room, and I saw the Japanese room, and everything. And after that, I was very interested. I said, Mommy, can I come to every day, every Sunday here? Weekdays, I was going to school. She said, every Sunday you can come to from 2 to 5. It's open from 2 to 5. You can spend your life from 2 to 5 here if you like. We'll be quiet, because I used to make enough noise for 10. Every day for 10 years, I went to the museum from 2 to 5, every Sunday. And that was my Asiatic formation. I learned the history of Asia, the little I knew of it in those days, from the museum. I had a book, the Musée Guimet, all this history of Japan and the mythology of Japan, mythology of China, of, well, old China, before Mao, of course, and all that, the popular religions. I was very interested. I liked it. Asia never felt foreign to me. I don't feel foreign here at all, any more than I do in Europe. In Europe, I feel at home with National Socialists, but with non-National Socialist Europeans, and especially with people I am against, I feel much worse than I do with indifferent people here. Here, at least, if they're not for, they're not against either. They don't care. Sorry. They let you in alone. They don't run after you because you are a Nazi. That's your right. And in the wartime, those that were for Hitler, they would take his picture and put it among the gods. Every Hindu house has a little shrine for the gods, with pictures of the gods. They put Hitler's picture along with them. And those that were for Stalin, Indian communists, would do the same with Stalin. Nobody did it with Churchill. Funny enough, it was Stalin or Hitler.
Amazing. That's amazing.
And the dream of my life is to integrate Hitlerism into the old Aryan tradition, to show that it is really a resurgence of the original tradition. That's not Indian, not European, but Indo-European. It comes from back to those days where the Aryans were one people near the North Pole. The Berberian tradition.
How do you think it will be done?
Centuries, it will take centuries. It will be done slowly. Every person will contribute to it, more or less. It will be done. It will not be done in this age, what we call in Indian the Kali Yuga, the Dark Age. But when after the Third or Fourth World War, I don't know, when the Dark Age will take an end, there'll be a new world, few people. There'll be Aryans and non-Aryans, all right. But the proportion between Aryan and non-Aryan will be better in favor of the Aryan. Because a great number of people will be dead. Mongrels will be dead, great number. The best will survive. They always do in the beginning of a cycle of four periods. The first cycle, the first part of the four periods, what they call in Indian the Satya Yuga, the age of truth. The age of truth is always the longest and the most peaceful. And then you get another age, and then another, and then the dark one, the one we are living in now. We are in it since about 3500 BC. It started then. It will last another perhaps few centuries.
It will last.
It will last. We mustn't expect it for tomorrow morning. We can expect for tomorrow morning topical, let me say, partial resurgences.
Like in Germany.
Like in Germany. Well, Germany was a partial region. It was for 12 years. It didn't last. It couldn't last in this area. This is a time when nothing good lasts. According to the laws of evolution, of manifestation, things don't last. Because the quality of the people is bad. And you cannot make a good omelette with bad eggs. Even the best cook cannot do it. The eggs are stinking. Now, in this period, you have 50 stinking eggs in one good egg. All over the world, if you take the world population.
How did the person Hitler came about?
He was a setback, something that was belonging to none of the ages. But his movement is typical of this dark age. If he had come in the Satya Yuga, in the golden age of the past, long ago, he would have been a man like another. They were all like him in those days. Everybody lived according to the laws of nature. He went against time, he went against the current of time. And as he was one of the latest ones, there's one that the Hindus are expecting, but not only the Hindus, the Christians say Christ would come again. Somebody would come. The Parsis say Sayashant will come. The Muslims say the Mahdi will come. The Buddhists say Maitreyi will come. They all were expecting somebody. If Adolf Hitler had been that somebody, he would have won the war. Even if he had the whole world against him, he would have won. But he didn't win. The only reason why he didn't win was that he wasn't that somebody. He was the forerunner of the one to come.
But isn't that what he said of himself?
He said it to himself. Mm-hmm. He knew it. He knew what he was saying. He said it to Hans Grimm in 1928, in a conversation with Hans Grimm. He said, "Ich bin nicht derjenige, der kommen soll. Ich tue nur die vordringlichste Arbeit. The all necessary work, preparing his work." And he knew he was going to fall. When he was 16, and went with Kubitzer. Kubitzer tells that in his book, Adolf Hitler, mein Jugendfreund. He went with Kubitzer to theater and saw Rienzi, the play. And it was 1 o'clock in the morning, came out of the theater. And instead of going home, he said to Rienzi, "Gehen wir zu Freienberg." Freienberg, the mountain near Linz, where they used to go to spend the Sunday afternoons. At 1 o'clock in the morning, through the fog, Kubitschek followed, they both went up, through the fog. Time came when they were on the summit of the Freienberg. The fog was below, they could see nothing, fog and stars. And then Kubitschek says in his book, "Then he caught hold of my hands and spoke to me with words that cannot be, retold, so great they are. And he unfurled in front of me his own future and the future of our German people." He was 16. He knew he was going to fall. He said, "I like Rienzi, I'll go up." Rienzi was a Roman of the 14th century. "I will be carried up by popular love, and I'll fall." He knew it. He couldn't do otherwise. He had to fight all the same, because a fighter is a fighter. Of course, he couldn't say that to the public. Couldn't say that to the public, he had to do his job. And his job was that, go against the current of time. Show that the Germans will go against the current of time. They are the ones. They are the best Aryans in Europe, not because they are the purest. The Swedes, well, up till now, are equally pure. Now they are taking in all sorts of, there's an a hateful organization here. Catholic, Mother Teresa, supposed to be the lover of children. They gather all the children they can. And if you want to adopt an Indian child, you can. They adopted 300 in Sweden last year, only last year. Little girls and boys of low caste, generally, as dark as possible. They adopted them. These children, when they grow up, first of all, they are uprooted from their surroundings. They will never use a word of Bengali or of Hindi again in their lives. They'll be Swedes, Swedes in appearance. But they are non-Aryans. The masses of India are non-Aryans. And they'll probably marry Swedish boys. And you get the end of Sweden, these beautiful Europeans. And that's encouraged. That's encouraged by the Indian government, this Swedish government. Because this government is nothing but under the impulse, under the orders of the international Jew. There's a strong Freemasonry here. This, and the Jews came during the war, or before the war, 1933. There were two styles of Jews. The stupid ones and the intelligent ones. The stupid ones were the richest, perhaps. They went into the British clubs for Europeans only. Brahmins, fair skinned. Brahmins were not allowed. They were Indians, nothing but Indians, natives. But a German Jew is not accepted. Oh, I'm a German. He never said, I'm a Jew, he said, I'm a German. And this tyrant is after us. All right, but norms come in. They were there and they stayed there. They gave money to the papers. Papers became anti-German within 3 months. Calcutta. They were not anti-German before 1933. They became anti-German. The Statesman, the Amrita Bazar Patrika, even the Indian papers. Money. The intelligent Jews didn't do that. Oh no. They sneaked into Indian organizations. One went to see Gandhi. Gandhi was popular then. She stayed with Gandhi 2 years. She's called Margaret Spiegel. She's a Berlin Jewess with 13 languages. Not stupid at all. And Gandhi accepted her. They stayed there. And when she had enough of Gandhi's ashram, she went to Rabindranath Tagore's. And Rabindranath Tagore accepted her, made her a teacher of German. Teacher of German. And she was teacher of German in Rabindranath Tagore's ashram. When I went there, in 1935 to learn Hindi and to perfect my Bengali. I used to speak Bengali and write Bengali already. I started learning Bengali in France. I didn't know a single Bengali or a single Indian. But I had read in French translation the novel of Sarat Chandra Chatterjee, Srikanta, and I liked it very much. And I said, if I have to begin with one Indian language, I'll begin with this one. All right. What's written there?
Oh, that's okay.
I see. So, I wanted to perfect my Bengali and to learn Hindi. I went to Shantiniketan, the open-air university near Bolpur in Bengal. The secretary of Rabindranath Tagore. Rabindranath Tagore was surrounded with Jews and ex-Christian missionaries and whatnot. They were his advisors, they were his friends. It wasn't a place for me at all. Well, I went there, it was cheap. £1.50, you could stay there 6 months. Eating and drinking and everything, and sleeping. £1.50, you can imagine. So I went there. The secretary of Rabindranath Tagore, Amir Chakravarti, a Bengali Brahmin, thought to himself, now this one is a white woman, name Sal, and this one too. He just can't make the difference between a Jewish and a German woman. But she didn't look Jewish, in fact. I'm going to bring them together, the two name Sals. So that's what he did. He introduced me to the German teacher, the Jews. 1935, you can imagine what I was in 1935. I was 30 years old, 29, even not quite 30, it was in July. I was going to be 30 in September. And I was arrogant. And arrogant, I mean, say, I felt that whatever happens to me in one part of the world, I always have Germany to go to. I have a place to go to. I couldn't care less. So I spoke very frankly. And she said to me this. She said, I left Germany on my own free will. I wasn't turned out. Because I didn't want to see the shadow of a Nazi anymore. Not the shadow of one. And I come here in a place of Indian culture and I meet you and you are worse than the whole pack of old Indian. I said, what makes you think that? She said, I'm feeling very honored. She said, well, they over there, they goose step along the streets and they sing, Heute gibt uns Deutschland, morgen die ganze Welt. But they don't think of the ganze Welt at all, they think only of Germany. Ganze Welt, they don't care. They're not interested. They're interested in their own country, I said, that's natural. But you, she said, you think of the world. You are not a Nazi because Hitler saved Germany. On the contrary, you like Germany because it's Hitler's country. I said, yes, so exciting. Exciting. So I said, what do you think I came to do? You came to make the elite of India your allies. I said, exactly. She said, no, you are. You're worse than the whole pack of all in one. They never thought of that. I said, if I had spoken to the Führer, we would have done something like that. I think it was the best thing to do. Well, in fact, the German Consul General of Calcutta in those days, and long before those days, he did that.